think our safest assumption at this point is that anyone can get this virus.
The spread of COVID-19 keeps getting worse. It's Wednesday, March 11th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Join us live on Facebook. Also ahead this half hour, world financial markets still reeling, another big primary for Democrats. And just where did all the women candidates go? That and more, all on today's VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping made his first visit to Wuhan on Tuesday, where the coronavirus outbreak forced an unprecedented lockdown of the central city of 11 million people in a sign that authorities' efforts to control the virus are working. Globally, there are at least 100,115,825 cases. That, according to the Center for System Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. Turning to Europe, all of Italy is now under lockdown, and tougher self-quarantine measures in Israel made on Monday how the global coronavirus epidemic was extending its reach. Reuters' Chris Dignam takes things from here.
La decisione giusta oggi è di restare a casa.
Italy's prime minister on Monday announced that travel restrictions would be imposed across the entire country just a day after locking down much of northern Italy, security measures that were already considered drastic.
Non ci sarà più una zona rossa.
There will not be any more Zone 1 or Zone 2 in the country. It will be Italy. Italy is a protected zone.
Un'Italia zona protetta.
The announcement made Italy the first country to restrict movement nationwide, a dramatic new clampdown aimed at halting the rapidly spreading coronavirus in Europe's worst affected country. The unprecedented restrictions, which ban all public gatherings and require people not to travel except for work or emergencies, come after an alarming jump in deaths tied to the highly infectious disease in Italy, with the death toll there reaching 463. More than a quarter of which were reported in the past 24 hours. Italy has more than 9,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus, putting the national health system under massive strain.
We are encouraged that Italy is taking aggressive measures.
In Geneva, the World Health Organization's director said on Monday that the coronavirus is now closer to causing a pandemic.
Now that the virus has a foothold in so many countries, the threat of a pandemic has become very real. But it would be the first pandemic in history that could be controlled.
In Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday also announced more aggressive measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus, requiring all citizens who return from abroad to self-quarantine.
After a day of complex discussions, we made a decision. Anyone who arrives in Israel from abroad will enter a 14-day isolation.
Israel had already taken some of the most extreme precautions to prevent a local coronavirus outbreak, forcing visitors from many countries in Asia and Europe into isolation. In the United States, passengers aboard the Grand Princess cruise ship that was barred last week from returning to its home port of San Francisco due to an outbreak of the virus on board waved and cheered as the ship docked at the nearby port of Oakland on Monday, while tents and workers wearing protective clothing waited for them on shore. 21 people on the ship, mostly crew, tested positive on Friday for coronavirus in an initial round of screenings performed on about 45 people with symptoms. The remaining passengers will be tested and monitored for signs of the illness once they reach the next unexpected phase of their voyage, 2 weeks at a quarantine station.
And we invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and, of course, voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Myanmar police say the army has filed a lawsuit against Reuters news agency and a local filmmaker for criminal defamation. Hillary Clinton says peace will take hold in Afghanistan only if it is inclusive, that foreign troop withdrawals must be conditioned on the Taliban meeting their obligations. Tibetan President in Exile Lobsang Sangye turned to urge the United Nations Human Rights Chief on Tuesday to visit Tibet to examine rights violations. And Hindus threw colored powder as part of the holy festival on Tuesday, but the enthusiasm was subdued because of fears of the new virus. Read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter, plus voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. After a market correction last week and massive sell-off on Monday, Asian stocks rebounded on Tuesday. U.S. exchanges were flabby in midday trading, and European markets closed down. To understand why, VOA's Steve Miller spoke to David Wilcox, non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
I think it'd be a fool's errand to try to predict where the stock market will be tomorrow, much less a month from now. But my guess is that we're in the process of investors coming to grips with a clearer perception of the reality of how serious this situation is. Even with the market being down considerably from its peak of roughly 10 days or so ago, we're still only about where we were at the beginning of last year. So I think it's, if anything, perhaps a little surprising that the market hasn't gone down by more in light of the extraordinary uncertainty that surrounds this situation.
People are very fond in saying the market is not the economy. What's your analysis as to what is the overall health of the global economy and how prepared is it for a long duration of interruption?
It's a great question, and a troubling aspect of this situation is that the familiar plays in the policy playbook just aren't very well suited for this kind of a situation. To take one example, monetary policy, which is oftentimes the sort of first resort in a time of economic weakness, operates with a pretty lengthy lag. 4 to 6 to 8 quarters is the typical estimate, and we just don't have that kind of time. Fiscal policy can oftentimes operate much more quickly, but the kinds of conventional fiscal policy moves are not well suited for this kind of a situation where the initial impact is going to be so disparate across different segments of the population. Just to take one quick example, there are going to be a lot of workers who don't have access to paid sick leave, and so designing a response that's customized and tailored to meet that kind of a situation is going to be a critically important challenge.
If we take a look just at the U.S. economy, because it is the world's largest, you see that 10-year yield, that inverse curve there. How important is it for the long-term effects of keeping the American economy going? You know, how long can it stay inverted before it needs to turn around?
Well, the fact that the 10-year yield is so low is absolutely critically important in one respect. That is that it's a great metric for showing just how little policy space the Federal Reserve has to boost the economy by dropping interest rates. There just isn't a lot of room at the moment. We're definitely flashing at least amber at this point in terms of the scope for the Fed, which, as I say, is usually sort of the macroeconomic first responder in situations like this. Fed's going to have very limited scope for action.
David Wilcox is a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Happening now in Asia, Afghanistan's president-elect Ashraf Ghani and his election rival, runner-up Abdullah Abdullah, took part in parallel swearing-in ceremonies Monday, fueling political tensions and posing a fresh challenge to U.S.-led peace efforts. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. When the new coronavirus was discovered, at least publicly in January, the Chinese government took what many believe were draconian measures, sealing off an entire city of Wuhan. In the past week, Italy has quarantined an entire section of its country due to the virus. If or when the coronavirus situation worsens in the United States, one expert says there could be a giant legal mess. That's what Polly Price, professor of both law and global health at Emory University in Atlanta, wrote in Atlantic Magazine. Professor Price spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman via Skype.
The problems really have to do with federal and state government cooperation. We've never had, at least in the last 100 years, we've never had the need for large-scale federal quarantine. And the quarantine authority traditionally is in state and local governments. And so what we've seen so far, just in terms of some legal conflict, is disagreement about where persons who are being repatriated from overseas should be held in quarantine. Normally, that would be a state and local government function, yet the federal government is in charge at the borders and at points of entry. So it's something that's really being worked out more along the lines of cooperation than by any pattern that we've seen before or by any precedent that we've seen before.
Is there an active or any active measures trying to deal with this? Is there talk between the federal government and localities and states? Is that going on now?
I'm sure that it is, because they have to have permission from each state health department before moving patients who may need to be quarantined. And so I think they've relied for decades on this cooperation between the CDC and state and local health departments, but we've never needed it on quite this scale. So I'm certain that these negotiations are going on. And let me give you an example. So the cruise ship that is just off the California coast took some delicate negotiations about where the people who are not sick but yet need to be quarantined, where they would be taken. And my understanding is they're going to be distributed between military bases in Texas and Georgia. And that required the consent of the governors. So the governor of Georgia, for example, said, we're all in this together. This is the right thing to do. You might compare that to what some listeners may remember a couple of weeks ago. The Alabama governor had refused to or did not want any quarantine passengers coming into Alabama and had called President Trump to get his agreement not to have them come in. So it is a federal state negotiation. Cooperative federalism, for better or worse, is how we have run public health in the United States. And I think seeing the kinds of quarantines that might be needed on a large scale is not something we have practiced or prepared for.
You are a professor of both law and global health at Emory University. Can the United States shut down an entire city? What would that take if that was necessary, and could that be necessary in your mind?
The authority is there to make those kinds of declarations. I don't think they are helpful or would be used in a way that would prevent travel, say, from one state into another.
Polly Price is professor of law and global health at Emory University.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
this news alert from VOA Asia. The death toll from the collapse of a hotel in southeastern China serving as a quarantine facility has doubled to 20. At least 71 people were believed to be inside the building in Guangzhou. At least 61 people have been rescued from the rubble. This is VOA Asia.
This is Business Inc. I'm Ira Melman. Hundreds of billions of dollars were wiped from financial markets, oil prices crashed, and Italy extended its emergency coronavirus measures to the entire country as the deadly new coronavirus disrupted economies and societies across the world. The IMF called on governments to deploy substantial stimulus and international coordination to counteract the economic impact of an epidemic that has spread to more than 100 countries since it erupted in December in Wuhan, China. The World Health Organization warned the threat of a coronavirus pandemic is now very real, but said the virus could still be controlled. Tens of millions of people are now in quarantine worldwide, but there are fears that the disease will spread further and force several economies into recession. Trading on Wall Street was temporarily halted early Monday as U.S. stocks joined a global rout on crashing oil prices and mounting worries over the coronavirus. Brazil's Sao Paulo exchange suspended trading briefly after a 10% plunge. In Paris, the CAC 40 index lost over 8%, its worst daily drop since the 2008 financial crisis, while the DAX Blue Chip Index in Frankfurt saw its sharpest single fall since 2001. Millions of people have seen daily life disrupted by school closures, with those announced Monday in Greece and Spain, as well as runs on basic household goods and travel restrictions. Shares in India's Yes Bank plunged last Friday after the central bank seized control and imposed withdrawal limits to prevent the collapse of the country's fourth largest lender. The move by the Reserve Bank of India sparked a sell-off across the troubled banking sector and sent the rupee falling to its weakest level since 2018. People queued outside Yes Bank branches after the announcement that customers could only withdraw 50,000 rupees over the next 30 days while the Reserve Bank of India tries to put together a rescue.
Definitely some child's education fees and some premium is there will be pending. So definitely, I'm worried about this.
The news added to liquidity concerns about India's financial system more than a year after the near collapse of ILNFS, one of the nation's biggest shadow banks, finance houses responsible for significant consumer lending. A resulting reluctance of banks to lend money has exacerbated the woes of Asia's third biggest economy, with growth slowing for seven consecutive quarters before picking up with a meager 4.7% expansion in the final 3 months of 2019. The Reserve Bank of India put the blame on serious governance issues and practices in recent years, but said there was no need to panic. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman.
Now on VOA Asia, in 2016, the state of Michigan gave Senator Bernie Sanders one of the most surprising primary wins in U.S. political history. In 2020, the self-described Democratic Socialist will need another boost from Michigan to revive his campaign to secure the Democratic presidential nomination over his lone remaining major rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. VOA's Jim Malone reports.
Former Vice President Joe Biden campaigning in Mississippi, looking to expand his lead in the Democratic race on Tuesday.
I really believe we're creating a movement and a movement powered by the backbone and base of the Democratic Party. A movement that's going to defeat Donald Trump and restore the soul of this nation.
Biden has picked up the endorsement of two former rivals, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker and California Senator Kamala Harris.
I believe in Joe.
Thank God for Bernie Sanders.
Biden's main remaining rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, touted the endorsement of civil rights leader Jesse Jackson as he campaigned in Michigan.
So brothers and sisters, let us go forward. Let's win on Tuesday. Let's win the Democratic nomination. Let's defeat Trump. Let's transform this country. Thank you all very much.
Sanders also continues to complain that the Democratic establishment has united to stop him.
The question, which is what the media is preoccupied with, how can we stop Bernie Sanders? We got to stop the coronavirus and we got to stop Bernie Sanders. What a terrible thing.
They'll call Super Tuesday for nothing.
Biden's dramatic turnaround in the Democratic race last week in the Super Tuesday primaries also caught the attention of President Donald Trump.
I was all set for Bernie. I was ready to go. And then I say, you know, I don't think I'm running against Bernie. I think it's going to be very hard for him to come back.
Biden won 10 of the 14 contests last week on Super Tuesday and totally reframed the Democratic race, says Larry Sabato.
I like to say that Biden was given the last rites, and now he's Lazarus because he has arisen from the dead. He has managed to surprise everybody and win a ton of primaries by landslide proportions in most cases.
Biden's success drove two other rivals from the race, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Which candidate can defeat Donald Trump?
Sanders' best chance to regain momentum may come Tuesday in the Michigan primary, says Jim Kessler.
If Bernie doesn't score a big victory in Michigan, you're really starting to see the end of the possibility of his candidacy. And then I think there'll be some unifying then.
In addition to Michigan, Idaho, Mississippi, Missouri, and Washington State hold primaries on Tuesday, and North Dakota will hold a Democratic caucus. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Finally, Senator Elizabeth Warren's exit from the Democratic Party's nomination race last week left many in the United States disappointed that the presidency seems to be out of reach for a woman. VOA's Brian Padden reports that Warren was the last viable female candidate in a historic field of six Democratic women contenders, and her departure reinforces concerns that gender bias still remains a major obstacle for women in America.
While campaigning, Senator Elizabeth Warren made a point of telling young girls, "I'm running for president because that's what girls do." In ending her presidential bid, Warren lamented that these little girls will have to wait another 4 years before another woman runs for the presidency, adding, "There's a contradiction in confronting gender bias."
If you say, "Yeah, there was sexism in this race," everyone says, "Whiner." And if you say, "No, there was no sexism," about a bazillion women think, "What planet do you live on?"
Warren, a progressive, was the last viable female candidate in a diverse Democratic field of contenders that once included six women. Only Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii remains, but is running far behind former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders. The 2020 U.S. presidential race has now come down to three white men in their 70s, with Biden and Sanders vying for the Democratic nomination to face off against Republican President Donald Trump.
For the United States of America!
After Hillary Clinton, the first woman to run for president as a major party nominee, lost to Trump in 2016, polls have shown Democratic voters are reluctant to support a female candidate this time around.
There was a sense that sort of tradition should prevail and that one needed, you know, a white man who was over 70 to go up against a white man who was over 70.
Clinton recently acknowledged that gender bias remains an obstacle.
There still is a double standard. There are still a lot of, biases about women becoming president. But I made a lot of progress, and I was thrilled that so many women ran this time.
Female presidential candidates continue to face criticisms over whether they are too emotional or not likable, critiques that are rarely used against male candidates. And there is still a perception among many that the presidency is a man's job.
We think of leadership, and particularly presidential leadership, in a certain way. And women don't fit into that yet.
While Warren and the other female candidates did not break through the proverbial electoral glass ceiling this year, advocates for women hope their campaigns will make it possible for a woman to someday win the presidency. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
And that is VOA Asia for today. Thank you so much for joining us on this very busy news day. We'll be back again with you tomorrow. We hope you'll join us as well then. And until then, be well.